33, Senator Michelle. And we'll have Senator Dibble after that.
Mr. Chairman, I would move adoption of the division report.
Senator Berglund moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. Senate file 2833 is the Abigail Taylor pool safety bill. As most of you know, Abigail Taylor is the six-year-old from Edina who just several weeks ago passed away from her injuries and complications from a transplant after she went through a pool incident last summer, summer of 2007. So when this bill began its journey a couple months ago, Abigail was still with us and fighting down in Omaha, Nebraska after a triple organ transplant. Mr. Chair and members, I have not asked him to testify, but Abigail's father, Scott Taylor, is with us today, and he has been instrumental in the drafting and the work and the advocacy for this legislation. So I just want to publicly thank Scott and also extend our sympathies from the State Senate for what he and his wife and three other daughters have been going through over the last since last summer.
Well, I appreciate that, Senator Michelle, and obviously Mr. Taylor, as I indicated to you before we started, very sorry on behalf of the committee with what's happened, but certainly appreciate your willingness to put this kind of effort into legislation that, as you and I talked before the committee hearing, I only wish maybe we'd had the foresight to look at, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. But certainly in the midst of all this, I think all of us are very appreciative of your willingness to work with Senator Michelle to try to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Then just a brief overview. Since we've been looking into this issue and working with the Department of Health, we know a lot more about pool safety today than we did just a year ago, thanks to Abigail. But we know the right equipment to use. We know how to maintain that equipment. We know we need to inspect it. So that's what this bill lays out, a state regimen of using the right equipment and inspecting it on a daily basis. We phase in some of these requirements, members, so that the first type of public pool that we want to take care of is the kiddie pools, the wading pools, which is where this incident occurred. Unfortunately, there have been a number of these eviscerations, is the term that's used, but specifically in wading pools. So that's really the red flag that we want to take care of. And it's typically an older pool as well. So we know how to retrofit and update these kind of pools. And, Mr. Chair, I am anxious to have this legislation passed into law so that we have the benefits of it this coming swimming season, right? We're going to have pools opening up in a matter of weeks here. So that's the overview. I'll also note that the that Congress, there's now federal pool safety legislation, which again was passed, frankly, because of the Taylors and because of the inspiration of this little six-year-old Abigail. So I don't think it's exaggerating to say that this six-year-old accomplished what many of us in this room can never seem to do, which is to get Congress to act. So we have federal legislation that is now online and becomes effective at the end of this year. Our legislation will marry up with that. And given that overview, Mr. Chair, there's a number of things we could do, but if you wanted, we could go through the fiscal side of this bill with Mr. Stein from the Department of Health.
Well, Sir Michelle, that would be, I mean, obviously we don't have to review all of the policy in the bill, but would certainly like to have just a little bit of testimony about the financing and the special revenue fund. So, Mr. Stein, did you want to do that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Link Stein. I'm the Director of Environmental Health at Minnesota Department of Health. The department's fiscal note is built on provisions of the bill that would increase the number of public swimming pools by definition and thereby expand the number of pools that are licensed by the state. Currently, public swimming pools are licensed and inspected associated with food, beverage, and lodging facilities that are licensed by the state of Minnesota for the Department of Health. Local governments also, where the department delegates that authority, license and inspect public swimming pools, and some local governments expand to other forms of pools that are currently not licensed by the state. So what the bill outlines is approximately an increase in 600 public swimming pools that will be licensed and inspected by the state as a result of this legislation. The fees then are calculated as revenue to the special government revenue fund, and that would be $191,000 a year in revenue. We estimated costs about $210,000 a year. The department would absorb through other funds any disparity there. The calculations are on the fiscal note, and that's how we arrived at the detail. I would say that the legislation does not modify the fee structure. It does not change fees. It merely expands the number of pools that will be subject to those fees.
Okay. And Mr. Stein, if I can ask, if there is, in effect, a deficiency of about $20,000, is there a reason you wouldn't suggest adjustment to the fees to take that into account?
At this time, Mr. Chair, our response to that is we're not entirely sure on the number of pools that we're going to be licensing. So we may come back in the future to adjust the fees. We expect a fee review of all of our food, beverage, and lodging fees, and our swimming pool fees would be associated with that in the next biennial cycle. So our plan would be to review the adjustment of fees once we have a better idea of the number of pools that are actually subject to licensure.
You know, the concern, and maybe I'm not going to make a point of $20,000, but in the conference committee, we had testimony from all of the commissioners over the last couple of days, two or three days, and certainly every commissioner talked about concerns, whether it be with not so much maybe with the governor's proposed budget, but if either the House or the Senate had reworked aspects of that budget, we heard concerns about even relatively small amounts. So I want to make sure with your testimony that we can accomplish this, because this is something we ought to be doing, but to make sure it gets done.
Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Berglund.
I think the issue here is that the department really doesn't know exactly how many pools there are that are not being inspected by the Department of Health today. And so the fiscal note is based on an estimate.
Oh, and Mr. Stein made that clear. So.
And so, you know, there easily could be more than 600 new pools that would be inspected and more fees being collected.
I mean, obviously, Mr. Stein, this is the non-budget year, and whatever happened, this is not general fund dollars, so I take it you'll see what the summer season is like this year and be in a position to come back next year.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Michelle, if I can just ask a general question about the bill. It's not so much about the fiscal impact. I just want to make sure I understand it. I'm trying to engross the division report, and it looks like you're exempting public pools that do not charge a fee for a couple of years. Is that, am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
This was an amendment that was worked out in the division, and there was some concern that not every unit of government that has these kiddie pools has budgeted for what could be a substantial expense in digging out around the whole pool and installing a second drain system. And so what the amendment said is that if they were not able to comply by the date in the bill, that they could submit a plan to the department that they would come into compliance within 2 years.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, and Senator Berglund, you know, I understand. You're right. I have no doubt it's very expensive. I know Minneapolis has this wonderful network of free kiddie pools in a lot of the parks. And I, when my children were a little younger, we spent a lot of time at those pools, as well as Roseville has one too. They're free and they're open to the public. And what are we going to do for the next 2 years if there's a possibility they could be dangerous? Will they be drained? Will they be closed? Will people be warned?
It
really is scary to think about having these still operate. I understand the budget constraints, but
well, I think that
take a chance on this?
There are portions of the bill that would still apply.
Yes,
it's just the major construction that could be delayed. So the provisions that they have to have covers over the drains,
right,
and that those covers have to be inspected on a daily basis, all of those things still apply in the bill. And for what it's worth, for whatever my opinion is worth, I think those are the more important parts of the bill.
And you're, Mr. Chair, and Senator Berglund or Senator Michelle, I mean, you heard the testimony about the details of this, but are you convinced that will keep children safe?
Mm-hmm. I believe that is the most important part of the bill, to have a safe drain cover so that the whatever suction there is that is causing the water to circulate isn't able to cause clothing or body parts to be entrapped. And I think that is a major important part of the bill. The other parts are added, but even in Senator Michelle's original bill, he did not anticipate those things having to be done immediately.
Senator Michelle.
Mr. Chair, and just to give a little more context to this issue for Senator Anderson, at first pass, we think there are 61 waiting pools in Minneapolis, and it looks like three of them would require some kind of retrofitting. It's been a little loose as to the estimates of how much that could cost to put in another drain. I mean, it's construction work. You couldn't do it overnight. There have been estimates as low as $5,000 per pool. There's been estimates as high as $15,000 per pool. And we have had testimony that doesn't seem like a lot of money, given the importance of, we want all our pools to get to the right place as soon as possible. My hope would be that as Minneapolis reviews its pools and its pool budget, that it sticks with the schedule.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Sanderson.
I don't know how many other cities or how many other communities around the state would have comparable pools, but if we're talking about that price tag, why don't we just pay for it? Why don't we just pay for it as a state? It's not a lot of money, and it's not something we should be messing around with.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berlin.
In trying to figure out how to solve this problem, I originally had thought that perhaps allowing communities that have this issue to apply for funds that were in the bonding bill for the children's facilities grants might be a solution, but that was vetoed in the bonding bill. So, I mean, I just don't know where we would get the money to pay for it. And I think these communities want to comply. They just want the comfort of knowing if they need a little bit more time to do it, that they would have the time.
Right. Mr. Chair.
Senator Michelle.
I know Mr. Taylor is anxious to speak to this particular topic.
Yeah, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you. I understand that budget times are tough and that we all need to make decisions. But if there's a decision between closing a pool for a season, paying $15,000, which I think is three times higher than the estimates that I'm accustomed to hearing, but for the sake of argument, let's say it's $15,000 per pool to retrofit. Given the choice between one of those and watching what happened to my daughter happen within the next 2 years to any of your children is a non-issue. If a local government cannot afford to to retrofit or fix their wading pool, then it should be closed. Bottom line. There's no excuse for us to cut a corner right now. And I would hope that we can take that out, frankly. That amendment was new from the last time that I read this, and I questioned it, and it was explained to me as to why it was added. And I'm learning how this process works. But since it came up, and Senator Anderson, thank you for bringing it up, my opinion is that there's no excuse for not fixing it or closing it down.
And Mr. Chairman?
Sir Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's important for everyone to understand that those provisions that require this retrofitting to create a second drain in kiddie pools goes above and beyond what's in the federal law that we are going to have to comply with. And so, you know, to say that a pool is not safe if it has the proper cover and is inspected daily to make sure that cover is connected properly, to say the only pool that would be safe is one that has a second drain, I think is taking things above and beyond really what others that have looked at this issue would consider the necessary safety standard. The only other state that I understand that has a requirement for second drains in their pools is Michigan. And so, you know, if we take a little bit of time, the House bill gives these pools extra time as well. I don't think that that's doing a disservice or creating a public safety problem.
I think the covers are the most important, too.
And certainly, Senator Anderson and Mr. Taylor would certainly concur in those remarks. And Senator Anderson, obviously, as you know, we just are out of general fund dollars. So if we're going to get this going this year, and it strikes me that there are many good public policy reasons to do so, we need to do it through a special revenue fund. I think everybody on this committee is aware we have something like $16,000 at the bottom line at this point after passage of House File 1812. And that just happens to be reality. Obviously, next year, in a regular budget and tax year, where we are dealing with the entirety of the state budget, there might be better opportunities. But given the deficit we have, given the fact that it's an off year, it becomes not difficult. We simply don't have the money. Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Michelle, are we looking at creating some kind of a redundancy system? Like, it says that the pool cannot be reopened or it has to be closed if it's missing or has a broken cover or grate, which it seems to me is the kind of the main protection. And then building this separate drainage system in which they have a you know, a couple years to put in, is that just, you know, say the grate breaks and no one sees it, so there's a separate drainage system as kind of as an additional level of protection?
That's right.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, the second drain system is really where there's a suction line where a pool that has a pump that's directly drawing water through the drainage system. With a compliant cover, that would reduce the risk of any kind of entrapment or hazard being in place. Further reducing that is to add a second drain line, because it would be very unlikely to have two drains covered simultaneously, increasing the suction. So, in effect, yes, it's an added measure of safety. It is a standard that the community that we consult with in terms of swimming pool safety advises, and as Senator Berglund mentioned, the state of Michigan has had that standard in place since 1971.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, as you know, my division is debating the parks budget, and I might suggest that we should go look at our budget and see if we could carve out a small amount of money to be available for grants to parks that have swimming pools in them. if we're really talking about a few thousand dollars per swimming pool, maybe there's a way we can make some money available through our parks budget. I mean, I don't know. I guess I need to. I haven't seen this bill before today. Obviously, we've heard a lot about it, but I don't want to feel. I mean.
Well, I would suggest then, Senator Anderson and Senator Michelle, if there is an opportunity to enhance the bill, I don't think anybody would object to that. I think, Senator Michelle, you'd like to have, if appropriate, this bill passed today to the floor so you can keep this moving. Senator Anderson, if you want to work on a supplemental basis without having the bill, without my sending the bill back, you know, keeping the bill here, send it to your division, you can certainly add something to your parks bill if you'd like to do that in the future.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's obviously, it's real upsetting to me, you know, to think that we're not going to do the job adequately here. So, sorry.
Well, I think.
I will do that. I'll take a look. And our working group is still, you know, we have yet to, we've been trying to find a time to meet. We tried to meet today. Anyway, so we still have our budget out there. We haven't brought recommendations yet to the conference committee. So I think we'll work with Senator Michelle and see if there's a way that we can find a way.
And Senator Anderson, you've been here long enough to know that certainly passed legislation that might in effect track in a couple different bills.
Absolutely.
Just so that one author knows what the other author is doing. Senator Berglund.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, I don't think there's anything wrong with this language staying in the bill. If communities have a source of funding to make these improvements, then the department wouldn't approve a plan to give them an extension. So I think, you know, the language in the bill is just sort of a fail-safe language.
Mr. Taylor.
That's the one part of the language that I agree with, is that you can't just apply for a 2-year delay. You have to submit a plan to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
However, I would hate for someone to be hurt during those 2 years or killed during those 2 years while they find it. Okay. That's my fear. And I understand that there may have never been an incident at the one of those three pools in the history since they've been open. I don't know that. There may never have been an incident in a Minneapolis pool. There was never an incident in MGC, to my knowledge, prior to June 29th. So to say that because it's never happened before, it won't happen now, that 2-year window is what scares me, that it's going to be open and operating during those 2 years.
Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Berlin.
Mr. Chairman, I understand your concern, and I certainly don't want any more children to be injured or killed. But that pool that we're talking about did not have a properly installed grate on it and was not being inspected on a daily basis to make sure that the cover over that drain was installed properly and working properly. The bill requires that to happen immediately. So I think there is certainly a greater degree of safety by passing the bill and leaving this major construction to have a little bit of a window to occur. I mean, clearly the bill itself allows a longer time for the bigger pools to comply, and we're not, you know, getting heartburn over that. So I don't think this is about whether we want kids not to be safe or not. I think it's just trying to, as Senator Michelle said in his original statements, allow some phasing in of this properly if it's needed.
Senator Pariseau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought you forgot this side of the table.
Oh, no.
I have a question to Mr. Taylor. That's why I've been trying to get it. I was wondering, we have more than one document in front of us. Are you speaking of the language on the division report or the original bill? And if you could identify the language you're concerned about. I don't think we were very specific about that.
And
that's what I thought, but I want to make sure that I understand it.
All right. Did Mr. Chair, Senator Pariseau?
It's on the division report.
I think you have
right
it now.
Senator Michelle? All right.
Yes.
Lines 124 through 128.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Michelle.
You talked a little bit about timeline and how we move forward. And I'd be happy to work with Senator Anderson going forward. I would welcome that. And I also think, though, we have hundreds of pools, hundreds of pool operators, and a 2008 swimming season that is approaching. And so I think it is important to keep this moving because, assuming its passage, the Department of Health is going to have a lot of work that it has to do immediately. This new inspection regimen will kick in. Certification of pools will be required. And so I do think we need to start getting the word out. So I appreciate your quick action.
That had been my best sense. Senator Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I agree that we should pass this bill out today. But I'm going to keep working on seeing how we can – I mean, this will start the process of getting things safer, and that's really important. But I want to make sure we're doing everything we can to finish the process as quickly as possible. And I wanted to ask a question also about private swimming pools. I mean, is it possible for a small home residential pool to have these same kinds of safety issues? And is there any regulation – is there anything that we're doing to help tighten that regulation?
Mr. Stein?
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, no, this bill does not apply to private residential swimming pools. The number of those pools in the state would be – tens of times greater than the number of the publicly available swimming pools. There is a swimming pool code that the industry adheres to in terms of the construction and maintenance of those swimming pools, but there is not at this time any licensing or inspection by the government of those private residential pools. Save for what would be included in this bill would be multifamily housing complexes. So that apartment complexes, association types of pools that are managed by an association for a condominium or townhouse association will be subject to licensure and inspection under this bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just say, I think probably most people who have a swimming pool in their backyard, well, I don't know, say they bought a house after it was already built, especially I would have assumed that there was some government regulation making sure that those are safe. I'm really surprised to hear there isn't, and that concerns me as well.
Senator Higgins.
I mean, there's building. I have a question for Mr. Stein on the fiscal note. In the assumptions section, there's a sentence that says that most of the unlicensed public pools are in the 7-county metro area, and the Department of Health is responsible for 3 of those counties, Scott, Dakota, and Carver.
Oh, sorry. Could you explain for me how is the Department of Health responsible for only 3 counties, and is it the counties then are responsible for pool safety and the rest of the counties, and how were these 3 counties, how did that abdicate to you rather than the counties?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, the answer is yes. We in the other 4 counties of the 7-county metro area, we delegate to the local units of government. The law sets up the responsibility for licensure and inspection of public swimming pools to the Commissioner of Health. The Commissioner then delegates that authority to local units of government. In Hennepin County, for example, there are multiple delegation agreements because of multiple community health boards. So the City of Bloomington, for example, is delegated licensing and inspection of public pools in the City of Bloomington. St. Paul and Ramsey County has a delegation agreement. Anoka County has a delegation agreement. So the 3 counties that are listed here are the counties that have elected as a county and a community health board not to take delegation from the Commissioner of Health.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Stein, then does that mean that the taxpayers of those counties where there is a delegation agreement are picking up costs that the taxpayers of these 3 counties are not?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, no. The counties that are delegated then apply a fee structure that they designate under their community ordinances, and then they collect revenues from the pool owners to operate the program.
Okay, so
similar
it's revenues,
to food, beverage, and lodging, similar approach.
And then, Mr. Chair, one last question. What about the rest of the state?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, there are delegation agreements across 47 local units of government in the state. It's about 40-60. It's about 60% Department of Health, 40% local unit of government in terms of numbers of pools I think I said that incorrectly, 60% local, 40% state regulated. So the local governments that would be adding to the licensing and inspection requirements under this bill have been informed and are aware that they will, if they're not currently, many of them are currently licensing and inspecting additional pools outside what the state requires. But if they're not, they've been notified that this is in the works and they may need to prepare for additional licensing. So in effect, there will be comprehensive coverage of the state for licensing inspection of the public swimming pools that are described. It'll be either the local unit of government or the Department of Health.
Thank you.
Sarah Pariso.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is to Mr. Stein as well. What about all those parks that call themselves water parks? They don't call themselves pool. I mean, we don't. Are they under the State Department then?
Mr. Chair.
When they're in several areas which are not metropolitan counties.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pariso, those pools are regulated by either a local unit of government or the Department of Health.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
I would move that Senate File 2833 be recommended to pass.
Okay, there is a proposed amendment to make sure the appropriation is made. Sarah Michelle, I'm told you've seen the A11 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
If we could have that distributed in this
Can
amendment.
I withdraw my amendment and I move my motion and I move the amendment.
Okay, let's wait till it's distributed. And this simply provides the appropriation language.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Michelle, and just out of curiosity, are most pools in compliance?
Yeah, Senator Michelle.
So most pools won't have to do anything. Is that kind of what's? You just have to inspect it and make sure that they stay in compliance.
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, I started to nod my head, and then I thought I should hesitate. I believe that most pools are in compliance. I think a lot of this will depend on the age of the pool. But this legislation will allow us to literally take an inventory. But, for example, in the Minneapolis situation, we know that 58 of 61 wading pools are in compliance with these requirements. So that's good news from a percentage standpoint.
And then in the area of, say, for example, hotels and with pools and they're regulated, obviously, also. And is that one of those things that do we know? Are they in compliance? Will they be required to make big changes? Or
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, the answer really is it depends. And Senator Michelle is correct on the age of the pool. Most pools that have been constructed in the last 5 years probably do comply. Most community swimming pools at high schools, middle schools, are going to comply already. The older pools that may exist in lodging establishments and in multifamily housing developments, those are the ones where it's going to depend upon how they've been constructed and maintained over time.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Sir Berlin.
I think it's fair to say that nobody was inspecting their pool covers on a daily basis last year. So that would be new.
All right. We have Senator Berglund's motion to approve the A11 amendment. Is there further discussion on the amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Then Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 2833 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you very much, Senator Michelle. Mr. Taylor, thank you very much for being with us. Thank you. And members and people in the audience, just so people are aware, Senate File 3140 will not be heard today, Senator Sharon. Next, we have Senate File 3096, Senator Dibble. And members, let me just indicate, I think there was a legislation of Senator Rosen's that is to be incorporated in this bill. Is that correct? It's in the lead all amendment, but we have two separate fiscal notes. So members should check the fiscal note for both Senator Dibble and Senator Rosen's original bill that are attached.
Senator Dibble.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Madam Chair, we have several. I'm not sure if they're in your packets. I think they are, but we have the division reports, which is the delete all amendment that was adopted in Senator Anderson's committee, and then we'll be taking up the A22 amendment. And if the full A22 amendment is successful, that'll result in the CE4, the committee engrossment.
So well, I think we'll start. Senator Mattson would move adoption of the division report. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
So thank you, Madam Chair. And so you'd like me to present the A22 is largely technical, and so we can probably get to those items after I present the outlines of the bill. Madam Chair, Senate File 3096 now is comprised of three bills, two of which are mine and one of which is Senator Rosen's, and they all are concerned with financing energy efficiency improvements and renewable energy projects at the local level. For local units of government, for state buildings as well, as well as for private individuals in Senator Rosen's bill. So I'll explain my bill, and then I'll have Senator Rosen explain hers very quickly. As you recall, last year, Madam Chair and members, the Demand Efficiency Act passed last year, and that sets forth fairly aggressive goals for our state, the utility companies in our state, working in conjunction with the public and private sector to really save energy at a much higher rate than we do currently under the current conservation improvement programs. So this bill is a way to work with local units of government and the state and utility companies to find some ways to enact some of those projects in a way that's cost-effective and allows for public budgets to be managed well. It also allows the state and local units of government to access very, very high-quality technical resources and allows them to interact with the private sector for the purpose of financing these energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. Some key features around private financing: it takes advantage with local units of government of lease purchase financing, if folks are familiar with that. It's used, I think, most commonly with school districts. That's a mechanism of financing capital improvements without going to a bond levy referendum. It's carried on the books as an annual appropriation. It's very common, for example, in purchasing bus fleets and the like. It allows, again, like I said, for very high-quality technical resources to study the potential energy improvements. It takes advantage of our existing B3 database. That's a database that we have developed in the state of Minnesota that has an inventory of many, if not most, public buildings and their level of energy that they use and potential energy improvements. And so this program will be targeted to first to those buildings that really stand out in that B3 database. It provides for the local units a mechanism to ensure that the level of savings that they realize from reduced energy bills continues to be realized. So there's no increase to their annual budget. In fact, there will be a net savings. The premise of that is that under current scenarios, they're paying so much on their energy bill, and they could be paying a lot less if they were able to do some of the improvements that were readily available, whether it's caulking windows or doing something to the envelope of the building or improving their HVAC systems or the like. And the problem, of course, is the capital expense up front. So it's a way of amortizing that capital expense over a period of time so that the amount that they pay every year is less than what their energy bill would have been. And if those savings aren't quite realized for whatever reason that was unanticipated, they have access to some dollars that are made available through a special revenue fund that we have in the state. It's called the oil overcharge. It's the result of a lawsuit that was settled many years ago, and it was established in the state fund for purposes like this. They can access some of those dollars to lengthen the term of the financing, again, to bring those annual costs down slightly. And additionally, with respect to the state buildings, the Commissioner of Commerce would administer this program in conjunction with whatever agency owns that particular building. It would be allowed, again, for the purpose of energy efficiencies or, you know, solar panels or something like that. Again, financing through the private market, and take advantage of the high quality technical resources. There's a strong emphasis on ensuring that either the locals or the state units are working closely with the utilities, so that all of the programs and tools that they have available for the conservation improvement programs, the SIP, you know, particularly as we amended and revised and approved that last year, are being taken full advantage of, and also ensuring that the utilities are able to count their effort in this financing mechanism towards their energy savings that they're required to meet annually from this point forward. If you'd like, I can go into describe the bill, Madam Chair, section by section, but my description really gives the broad outline overview of what exactly we're trying to accomplish.
Well, and Senator Dibble, the committee is primarily focusing on the fiscal.
The fiscal note is in front of you. There's no impact to the state general fund. And in fact, probably in all likelihood, no dollars, even in the oil overcharge account, it's called the Petroleum Violation Escrow Fund, would be used if we do this well and do this right. That's just simply available, except for some administrative tasks. But if we do this right, all of the financing would be coming from the private sector through banks, through well-established, well-defined, commonly used lease purchase financing.
But there is a potential special revenue impact for Senator Rosen's portion of the bill.
That's correct. In the early years, there will be a special revenue. And the reason for that is, if you allow me, the reason for that is what Senator Rosen proposes to do is set up a revolving loan fund. So the source of the fund would be repaid and go back into the special revenue fund, and the repayment won't be a one-for-one in the early years. The one-for-one, you know, kind of got to get the ball rolling. The repayments won't catch up with what's going out for a few years in the early years, and that's the impact in this newly created special revenue fund. With that, why don't I explain my second bill?
Madam Chair, before we leave this, I would
Senator
like to
Parasol.
Have, I have a question about, I'm looking at page 9 of the division report, and local government, defining local government. I'm wondering, because you have on line 925, units operating under an agreement to exercise powers jointly, is there any possibility or any intent that some of these grants or whatever they might be called, loans, are also extended to 501c3s through an agreement with some local unit of government or not? And is that appropriate that it should ever happen? I am not certain that we ought to be funding 501c3s who want to do something whooshy, you know, to show how great they are for the community.
Mm-hmm.
If it's the community's thing, then maybe the community should support it.
Mm-hmm.
Or fund
Senator
it.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The answer to your question, I think, is no, if I understand
Good.
It correctly.
Good.
Yeah, only
I'll
only
try to remember that,
only public units of government. You know, we could put language in that says shall not be used for 501c3s
well,
or something like
doesn't
that.
It doesn't sound like it, but then right. You never know, because typically mm-hmm. 501c3s can partner with local units of government mm-hmm. and access things that they couldn't
right.
buy themselves.
Right, yeah. Well, that's not my intent, for the record.
Thank you.
And I would be opposed to any effort for a private entity to come in under this. There is an opportunity under Senator Rosen's bill to access some advantageous loan terms through her program, but that's different.
Thank you.
All right. Very quickly, Madam Chair. Then my other bill, which was amended onto this bill, is largely a technical fix that allows. Local units of government, real focus on public housing authorities to extend the terms of their energy efficiency financing from 15 to 20 years, and those are really changes that are coming down from Housing and Urban Development A lot of the local the public housing authorities are doing fairly extensive energy efficiency renovations to their aging buildings, and in order for them to do the extent of renovation, they need to extend the terms of those loans so they can bring those annual costs down, and that's how the HUD regs are keyed. They're not keyed on 15 years anymore. They're keyed on 20 years, and so it's simply and state statute didn't conform with that, so this is conforming state statutes to that changing reality.
Any questions on that portion of the bill? Seeing none, then, Senator Rosen, do you want to explain
yes,
your portion?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This portion of the bill is the Micro Energy Loan Program, and it basically authorizes the director of the Office of Energy Security, which is a spinoff of the Commissioner of Commerce, and they can develop and implement and administer a loan program, a microenergy loan program, which authorizes $20 million in state revenue bonds to issue low-interest, long-term loans to units of local government to finance community-owned or publicly-owned small-scale renewable energy systems. It also would provide financial assistance to individual homes and business owners to install technology that is specifically dealing with solar, wind, geothermal, biogas, and microhydro. So that's just the crux of that of the bill. The Commissioner of Finance, if requested by the Director of the Office of Energy Security, will shall sell and issue state revenue bonds for the cost of the local energy initiative, number two, to pay the cost of issuance, debt service, and bond insurance, and to fund the reserves, and number three, to refund the bonds issued. The bonds are not a public debt, and they are not a general or moral obligation. The loans must be a minimum of 15 years unless the commissioner decides to shorten them of no less than 10 years. And this initiative basically is to get the resources that we already have available in this state utilized by small businesses, owners, and residential housing. There is the fiscal note is in front of you, Madam Chair and members.
Right, and the fiscal note does say that it will take a third FTE to administer the program.
That's right.
And that would be absorbed by the Department of Commerce.
That's right.
And I guess I'm just wondering if the Department of Commerce has agreed to absorb that and out
Madam
of
Chair
what
members,
funds.
Madam Chair and members, this is the Department of Commerce's initiative. It's the governor's initiative.
And so what source of funding would they absorb the third of a position from? I mean, is it general fund or is there some special revenue they have within the department? Most of the Department of Commerce is financed off of special revenue. So I'm just wondering.
Madam Chair.
I would think just it would be absorbed by the
Okay. Madam Chair, we have Jeremy DeFebre here from the Department of Commerce who is prepared to answer your question.
Okay. Mr. DeFebre.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeremy DeFebre. I'm with the Office of Energy Security in the Department of Commerce. And that third FTE would be absorbed through, we do have some general fund appropriation for the State Energy Office, and we also have federal funding through the State Energy Program that provides formula grant funding that funds a significant part of our non-regulatory activities in the Office of Energy Security also.
And you would be able to absorb that even with cuts that are being taken by the agencies in the budget?
Thank you, Madam Chair, yes.
Any other questions? Senator
Chair,
Dibble, you mentioned you had an amendment.
Yeah, it's the A-22 amendment, Madam Chair.
And that's in your packet, members. Do you want to give us an explanation of the amendment?
Madam Chair. The first part, page 1, lines 3 and 4, that strikes some language that relates to the generation and transmission of energy that would have been allowed or would be allowed under the current language in the state efficiency and renewable energy project. That was of some concern to the utilities because it raised their concerns about who's generating, who's selling, who's transmitting energy. So it simply deletes that kind of language. Page 1, line 5, just a technical definitional correction. Page 1, lines 6 and 7, again, a technical clarification. Much of this amendment, Madam Chair, was drafted with the assistance of counsel, John Fuller and Peter Watson. Page 1, lines 8 and 9, deletes language that's repetitive. Page 1, lines 10 to 21, as well as several later amendments, deletes some language around that allows the utilities, requires the utility that these projects be done in consultation with the utilities to take full advantage of the conservation improvement program and ensures that the utilities can count that effort towards their savings. And we kind of reorganized and rewrote some of that so it made more sense. So the same original intent of the bill is maintained in a more elegant fashion. Page 1, line 22, page 1, line 22 to page 5, line 5. Rewrites the microenergy loan proposal in Senator Rosen's bill, and it simply changes how the bonding works so that it makes sure that it's clear that this is a revolving loan, that the proceeds of the bonds go back to repay that special revenue fund that's set up, and it continues to revolve and replenish itself. And it also talks about all the legal obligations and responsibilities relating to that mechanism. On page 5 of the amendment, lines 6 to 31, lots of technical and terminology changes. You can review those, but I read them. They're the kinds of things that Senator Higgins tends to catch, or Senator Frederickson. It also deletes a requirement that the school districts submit these particular contracts to the Department of Education. Rather, it invests the Department of Commerce with that authority. But then on page 5, line 32, up to page 6, line 4, it allows for some coordination between the Department of Commerce and the Department of Education for the next couple of years. The Department of Education still wanted to be made aware of these projects that are of a capital nature, just to make sure that they were conforming to all the kinds of things that the Department of Education tends to when school districts do these sorts of things. And so it allows for that coordination, and that expires in 2 years. We have the chance to revisit that if the Department of Education has some serious concern about the kinds of projects that are being undertaken, as they might impact the larger education mission of that particular school district.
Questions about the amendment? Senator Anderson moves adoption of the amendment for Senator Gibbel.
Madam Chair, I'm just trying to read the new language about the bonds and understand what the difference is, because it's long. Page 5 to 8.
Somebody needs
maybe
to move
Mr.
it.
Maybe Mr. Watson. Yeah, I'll move it. I'll move okay. it, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure before we
right.
vote.
No, we're not voting. We're just getting it in front of us so that we can ask questions about it. And your question, Senator Anderson?
I just want to ask Mr. Watson if he could give us just a brief explanation of all the changed language in the new sections relating to, I think it's mostly bonding language.
Mr. Watson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. The division report had four different appropriation sections in it. This deletes three of them and makes the one appropriation that was in Section 5 of the bill as just part of a subdivision into its own subdivision. And you'll find that on the A22 amendment, page 3, at the top of the page, subdivision 8. So all that language that was in four different places is now right here and tries to make clear that instead of this being a kind of a revenue bond program like our 911 system revenue bonds where there's money coming in from outside and the legislature authorizes from time to time a new bunch of bonds to be sold, those bonds do their work, construct towers for 911 system, and then they are paid off with the revenue from the telephone surcharge, sort of a once-through bonding program, that in this case, the revenue to pay off the bonds is from the repayment of the loans, and the amount of bonds that's authorized is an aggregate limit of the amount outstanding at any time is $20 million, and you'll find that over on page, same page on line 18. Mm-hmm. So that, as Senator Dibble and Senator Rosen explained, the bonds may be paid off, but then new bonds may be issued just so long as the total outstanding at any one time are not more than $20 million. That's the basic thing done with the bonding. Then the name of the account is shortened to just be the microenergy loan account. In Section 5, the language that was in a variety of paragraphs and clauses and so forth is kind of resorted into subdivisions. And other than reorganizing and adding some captions, that's about all the change that's made to Section 5.
Any other questions about the amendment? Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, a question for Mr. Watson. I'm kind of enjoying looking at some of the changes on the amendment, things like changing prior to before, which has always bugged me around here. But I also see that you're changing funds to money. And then I always kind of chuckle when I see monies around here. But could you enlighten us in how the two words differ in usage in a situation like this?
Mr. Watson.
A fund is a group of accounts in which we keep track of the inflow and outflow of money. But in common parlance, especially with federal money, it's so alliterative to say federal funds. We talk about federal funds all the time and confuse money and funds. But in our statutes, I try to keep them distinct.
Thank you.
Ask if there'll be a test.
Any other questions about the amendment?
Yes, one more question. Is the usage of the word monies ever appropriate?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I believe in the dictionary, and maybe even in Black's Law Dictionary, it's given as a variation. It's not the preferred usage. It's more archaic.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Senator Tomassoni.
Madam Chair and Mr. Watson, the fiscal note that is on this, then, is it still accurate? Because it does say cost of the state $4 million in fiscal year 2010, and the language sort of implies that there's no state money involved here.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomassoni, I think the fiscal note is still accurate. That is, the change made by the amendment doesn't affect any of that. And this is state money. It's bond proceeds that are put into a special revenue account in the state treasury. And they come in and they go out. The various amounts, the $4 million and the $11 million and so forth, I think are estimates of how quickly a pool of loans can be put together. As I think Senator Rosen explained, they've got to have some money available, then they get this group of borrowers together, and they act as a pool then to go to the market, sell the revenue bonds, take that money, and then make all the loans. That's going to take some time. That is, you have to first identify the borrowers who are going to be in the pool before you go out and sell your bonds and put the money into the treasury and spend it out of the treasury. And I think that maybe Mr. DeFibre would have more on that, but I think that's the reason for staging it out over several years.
Any other questions on the amendment?
So, Madam Chair, the fiscal note is just indicating what the cost will be, but the actual payment of the bonds will be non-state revenues coming back. Correct.
That's correct.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, that's correct.
And so
Non-state revenue from the repayment of the loans.
So ultimately, there's no cost to the state.
Correct.
No cost to the general fund.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Tomasoni, to clarify the who is applicable for these loans, it's any city, county, a district authority, a political division, sanitary district, Met Council, the Port Authority, Economic Development Authority, Housing and Redevelopment Authority. So it is, as Mr. Watson said, going to take some time to instigate these loans, and that's why you have a $4 million in fiscal note in 2010 and then on up.
Any further discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor of the A22 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Dibble, are there other amendments?
No, Madam Chair, none. Not that I have.
Are there any other questions about the bill? Senator Anderson, do you want to make the motion?
I will. I will move that Senate File 3096 as amended be recommended to pass.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you.
The next bill is 2651, Senator Saxhog.
That's a lot of paper for one bill.
This is very interesting. Stacia sent me the joint explanation statement of the Committee of Conference. From Congress.
Oh, that's what I call a conference committee.
Yeah. When they did the mandatory cap increases.
Okay. Welcome.
The managers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a report from Senator Anderson's committee. That
Senator Anderson, do you want to move your division report?
So moved.
Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2651 is, for the main part, a result of the Forest Land Consolidation Working Group I chaired this recent interim under Senator Anderson's Budget Division. This is the seventh stop for this bill. So it's kind of been through the paces. The language in this bill is the first step to trying to get a handle on what I've expressed as one of the great threats to Minnesota forests, that being fragmentation and the best way to enhance forest management, consolidation. Madam Chair, I have the A4 amendment that I'd like to have moved, but I could probably describe it first, and if you wouldn't mind. The A4 amendment is... Does everybody have it or
no?
The A4 amendment. Can we get it distributed? Do you want to explain the amendment, Senator Saxhog?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A4 amendment will put into law the unallotment the Department of Natural Resources has proposed to the Forest Management Investment Account this year. I will make the changes permanent and help bring some stability to the account. There's been a downturn in the income that's come into that account because of a downturn in the wood products industry. So I have Dan Mueller with me here to describe that amendment if anybody has any questions or...
Madam Chair, I'll move the amendment.
Senator Tomasoni moves adoption of the amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
And Madam Chair, I have people from the DNR and from Bowser to describe other sections of the bill, which are, of course, the policy sections, if you'd like.
Are there questions about other sections of the bill? I don't see any. Senator Tomasoni moves that Senate File 2651 as amended be recommended to pass. Any discussion? Senator Betzel.
I'm trying to engross everything. The bill, the second engrossment, had the blank appropriation in Section 4, I think the A4 amendment did that, but was Section 4 then deleted, or how is that?
Madam Chair,
Senator
Betzel, that came out in Senator Anderson's committee and was put in the in her budget bill.
I see, okay. There it is on page 3. Thank you. Yeah.
Any other questions? Seeing none, then those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
If we can go next to Senate File 3058, Senator Rest. Is there a division? Senator, I'm trying to see anybody on the division. Anyway. Senator Berglund moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Rest.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 3058 is a bill that implements the Urban Partnership Agreement competition that the state won last year for a grant for federal dollars for metropolitan areas to address congestion. The corridor that was finally chosen as our project was the 35W corridor south of Minneapolis out to the southern suburbs. The agreement from the federal government has to have approval in statutes for driving on a shoulder lane and also for using congestion pricing or tolling in this corridor. And that is what, and it has to be done by May 12th. This bill is in a transportation policy bill, but we also would like it to be moving, that the committee already passed. We'd also like it to be moving separately so that the approval can be done in a timely fashion and the federal government can acknowledge that indeed is part of Minnesota state statutes. That is the proposal. I do have a request for an amendment that now I can't find, but I believe the committee has.
Okay, this is the A4 amendment?
That's correct. It's the A4.
Okay, if we can have that distributed.
Amendment. Must have given my copy of it away. Sorry. And it addresses the way in which the funds are allocated. And it is a we made a change in the transportation committee, and since that time in working with the department have come up with what I think is a more equitable approach. So if someone could make the A4 amendment, I appreciate it.
Okay, and Senator Rest, before we vote on the amendment, you indicated that you came up with a more equitable approach. Can you offer some definition to that?
It was a the allocation was skewed away from the Department of Transportation with regard to this and to Met Council, and we're just I thought that that was a bit harsh. It was Senator Dibble's amendment. Talked with him. He's comfortable that with this language as well. And if the committee would, I would appreciate it if you would do that. But and we have people from the department here who could explain it as well, what this change would mean.
Okay. Is there somebody who'd like to offer a little bit of testimony on the change?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Bernie Arsenault. I'm the director of the Office of Traffic Safety and Operation for MnDOT. And we had been working. We jointly submitted this application for the Urban Partnership Agreement program and grant with the Met Council, and we had consulted together to determine how to deal with the revenue distribution from the MnPass lane on the 335W corridor. We had adopted or agreed to a 50-50 split of some remaining dollars once initial operating costs and so forth are removed. Senator Dibble had offered an amendment that would take all the remaining dollars and distribute those to Met Council. What this does is it goes halfway back. So Met Council and Transit Operations still acquire the majority of the remaining dollars, but not all of them.
So it was first 50-50, and then it went to 100%, and now it's 75-25 in the amendment if it's adopted.
Sarah Betzel. Well,
Mr. Chair, I've got a procedural question, because it's my understanding from Senator Rest that this is in the Transportation Policy Committee, which the conference committee has already passed the House and is waiting for action in the Senate.
No, in the 2008 Transportation Policy Bill, not the 2007 bill.
No, but that's the one that is awaiting a vote in the Senate. So if we were to pass this, and we've got a separate conference committee report, and there isn't both bills, but if it's different, what prevails?
Mr. Chairman,
the bill that it was put into was the 2008 bill, which we have not taken up yet. And if we pass this separately, it can be deleted out of that.
What's the one that's the conference committee that's ready to be voted on?
It's not in the 2007 conference committee. That this bill is just this year.
Okay.
She's got this meeting right now, Tom Hanson. Okay. Sarah Betzel,
If it's in both bills, are we going to be able to make sure that if we start amending, adopting amendments, and if both bills wind up passing, which one prevails?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzold, if this bill goes to the floor, I would ask Senator
Murphy.
To take that section out of the take those sections out of the bill, and we would, at any rate, if it stays in the transportation bill, ask him to accept this amendment as well, so that the two versions are alike. And as we know, there are a lot of bills that are being included in omnibus bills that are also traveling separately.
Well, but where there's usually what we've been doing is the policy bills with few, if any, exceptions are parallel to what's happened on the finance end of it. So if there is going to be a difference, we're going to have to ask you to make sure you track that and make sure that Senator Murphy is in agreement with you.
Yes, I certainly would do that, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other questions? Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I'm just reading the fiscal note here, and it indicates that the costs of collecting the fees for the passes would be approximately $400,000 the first year, $800,000 the second, and $1 million, and then grow even further as usage increased. Or was that the total fees collected, or the cost of collecting the fees? Because I'm thinking 25% of $400,000 isn't going to cover the cost.
Mr. Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling. Right, these are anticipated costs of operation and anticipated costs of or anticipated revenues that would come in. And on the first year, our revenues are going to be much lower for a couple of reasons. We don't have a full year, and it's also going to open in phases. But as we move along, we believe that the revenues will surpass the operating costs, and there will be a distribution beyond those operating costs. These are our estimated dollars based on what we know about the 394 corridor and merging the two systems together.
So, Mr. Chair,
Carolyn.
So this formula of 25% and 75% only kicks in after the costs of collection are taken care of.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, that's correct as the revenues increase as we move forward through the years.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I've got more of a general question, and Council may have to help me out with this, but as I recall, the transportation bill that was passed, was there a reference to toll roads in that bill? I thought that there was, as I recall, at some point there was some kind of reference, and I can't remember if it was in the final bill or not. Actually, I believe it does anyone?
I don't know. Senator Roebling?
In fact, I do remember this because it said that we could not have toll roads. And I questioned Senator Murphy about that, but it was the way they got support from the trucking industry for the bill. It was by including that because that was a big issue for the trucking industry. I don't, you know, this is somewhat of a toll, but as long as there's free lanes next to it, I think that they don't consider it a toll road because the truckers could use the other lanes.
And Mr. Chair, that was kind of my follow-up. What's the difference? Is it the difference between a fee and a tax, kind of? You know, because you know, when they're talking about fees, that strikes me as a toll. But if that's the difference,
I'm not sure. Do we have an expert who could help us out,
Mr. Chair? I did speak with Mr. Hasladen, the executive director of the Minnesota Trucking Association, about that provision in the bill. They're comfortable that the UPA fits nicely within their concerns. Their concerns are that general purpose lanes be removed from availability for truckers. That's not occurring in this case, and they will continue to monitor, you know, congestion pricing as it moves forward. But he is comfortable with the UPA and believes it to be a positive project.
And Mr. Chair, I realize this is kind of out of, but we have defined toll roads somewhere as something, you know, we have a definition of it somewhere, and this doesn't qualify. Am I correct on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, when we talk about tolling, we sometimes synonymously talk about congestion pricing. This is a toll facility. But it is not the conversion of a general purpose lane to a toll. This is a conversion, in part at least, of a high occupancy vehicle lane to a toll facility, which is in the law, and authority is provided to do that.
Mr. Chairman, also specifically on lines 2.21, the reference to the tolling statute is made there, and that this project does not come under that prohibition.
Mr.
Chair, Senate Council,
Senator,
just
where are you? Which
two,
one are you looking
2.21.
at?
2.21. Yeah, the first engrossment. Page
Mr.
Two,
Chair,
line 21.
Senator, so those the references to statute there.
Yes.
Okay.
Is
all right.
Was where the
so that Mr. Chair,
for this
Senator,
particular project, that's the tolling statute doesn't apply.
Somewhere in those references, there's a definition of a toll
yes.
road. And,
yes.
Okay. Thank you very much,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fischbach. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Further questions on the A4 amendment? Does somebody wish to move the A4 amendment? Senator Higgins does. Further discussions on the A4 amendment. If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. That was an enthusiastic amendment.
Good ground.
Want to redo?
You had your chance. Further discussions on Senate File 3058.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Just real quickly, are these lanes, can they be used at certain times of the day and by people who don't pay the fee, or do you have to pay the fee in order to use this at all times?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, the lanes can be used if it, let me back up. There are two types of operations we're talking about here. One is the HOV lane, which is south in the Crosstown Project and south to where the existing HOV lane is. Those lanes during non-peak periods can be used at no fee. They'll be open just like the 394 MinPass lanes. North of 46th Street is where we're going to operate the price dynamic shoulder lane. The price dynamic shoulder lane will either operate as a price lane or as a shoulder, not as a general purpose lane.
And can people use them during certain periods of time without paying the fee, without being a price?
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, not the shoulder lane. They cannot use that without it will not be open as a lane unless it is priced. Mr. Chair, and just to clarify, HOVs are still free in the whole corridor, just like they are on 394.
During certain
as long as you qualify, as long as you have correct. Two or more people in the car.
Okay. Further questions? Discussion? Does anybody wish to take any action on the bill?
No, I'll move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 3058 as amended be recommended to pass. Now let's, if we're going to vote for this, let's show a little bit more enthusiasm for the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd really, really, really like to move this bill.
All right, that's
the
spirit.
Really drawn the vote okay.
All right. On that note, all those in favor signify by saying yes.
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 Opposed. Okay. Good work, committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator West, I just couldn't tell what they were thinking.
And I know. Neither could I. I was wondering.
That previous vote. Senate File 3193.
Chairman, I also have
is there a division report?
An amendment for this bill that council has, and then at some point an explanation of why the fiscal note then goes away. And I would, at least as I understand it, through the amendment and would, at appropriate time, ask Mr. Mosman or Mr. Watson to give the committee the explanation for that. What Senate File 3193 does is to provide a process through which adult adoptees born adopted prior to 1977 gain access to their original birth certificate. This is a project that's been long in the making that has involved hours and hours of discussion among adoption advocates and members of the adoption triad community and the adoption agencies. Those two groups not always agreeing in the past, but in this instance have, with this bill, as it is currently in place, have agreed that this is a worthwhile compromise that represents the best interests of all the parties involved. And the amendment that needs to be taken up is to delete Section 6, which is the where the fee is for the issuing of the new a new birth certificate or the original birth certificate, and I would ask Senate Counsel or Chief Fiscal Analyst to explain how that works. And it's in particular, it's impacted by the enactment date or the effective date, which is July 1 of 2009.
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Rest, the bill as it's before you has, there would be a fiscal impact to the bill even if the section that Senator Rest referred to was stricken, because there is some authority to collect $9 rather than $18 from the department. I think the issue, Senator Rest and members, is that the bill, when the fiscal note was prepared, overlooked the fact that the effective date for the entire bill is effective July 1, 2009. So there, the fees would not begin to be collected until fiscal 10. The other issue is that there was no direct appropriation in the bill for the agency to actually spend the money. But because the bill is not effective until July 1, 2009, I think that all of that is something that could be addressed when the biennial budget is next session. So you would not have to, from a fiscal impact standpoint, remove the provision that you are referring to unless you wanted to reduce the authority for the fee authorizations in the bill from the $18 to the $9 that could be obtained under current law. And I would just add that the additional fee was in the bill because the agency in the fiscal note is anticipating additional costs related to this relative to what they do in current law.
But, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mossman, that would not occur until the next biennium. So.
Correct.
And I just wonder if it's more appropriate, and I'll take the counsel, is it more appropriate to take that section out because they may find that the actual cost of doing that is $20. And if we put this in the bill this year, it would limit them. Am I correct in that? Or what? I really don't know the best way to proceed, and had been told that taking that section out was better. But if it's not, then I don't have any objection to leaving it in.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest and members, I think you have a couple of choices. If you could take it out, in which case then you would have some additional authorities that would be required of the agency that you would be putting into law. The agency undoubtedly would probably then come to you next session and say, we have these additional responsibilities and we want to adjust the fee, et cetera, accordingly, and this is what mm-hmm. we think it's going to take to do that. Mm-hmm. The other option is that based on the fiscal note, the agency is currently estimating what their costs are expecting to be and the fee that would be needed to cover those costs. You could leave the provision in the bill, and if there are changes to that, you could revisit the level of that fee next session, when the agency will have to come forward anyhow with a direct appropriation request for the amount.
Right. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, my advice to you would be that you leave the fee in
okay.
the bill, because that gives direction to the agency of what the intent of the legislature is,
okay.
rather than having them have to try to figure that out and invent something to bring back next year.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, thank you. Then I have no suggestions for an amendment, and I would take that advice.
Hey, Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the first time this year that I've had a chance to look at this bill, and I've been trying to read the summary in the bill. And I was reading the repealer. And quite frankly, I kind of like the language in the repealer for how birth parents would be sought out for seeking permission to release the birth records. And I kind of understand, Senator Rest, in here it does say that the department has to prepare an affidavit of disclosure, but I'm not sure how that gets to them, because putting it on a website is not something that I consider a good way to inform people.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, currently any adoption after 1977, the birth parents already file either an affidavit of disclosure or non-disclosure. Prior to that, adoptions, those birth parents after that time would have that opportunity as well, but they may not have known about that. In the past, the efforts and legislative efforts have just said that if a an affidavit of either disclosure or non-disclosure, when someone can change their mind at any time from one to the other, is not there, that the birth certificate would be issued. But the compromise that we have worked with the agencies and the department is that the department is going to be the coordinator for outreach activities. And one of the things that the department itself will be doing is the website where anyone can go and download the affidavit, either of disclosure or non-disclosure. It does need to be notarized, but can file that at any time, and again can change their mind at any time. The outreach activities are going to be done throughout this next year with the department and with the cooperation of the agencies. It will be, however, and what this is what was important to the agencies, that the although I must say that Lutheran Social Services still has some questions about how that's all going to work, but Catholic Charities and the Children's Home Societies are very comfortable with the language, that they would be working and not outreach materials would not be such that they would be encouraging people to file an affidavit of disclosure, but simply stating what the law is and making sure that the outreach materials are neutral and just make sure that people are as aware as possible that the opportunity is there to file an affidavit of non-disclosure or an affidavit of disclosure. In the past, when there has been a 100% requirement, we have seen that that is, and all parties have seen, that's just not workable. There may be, a birth parent that now lives in Africa or Asia, and the notion that we would, in order to affect this change in the law, that we would need to reach that person as well, just didn't seem to be practical anymore, and unlikely that it would be an issue. So this is a change, and it is considered a compromise between proposals, even ones this year, that gave an unfettered right, quite frankly, to an adult adoptee to get the birth certificate. And it is something that I don't think anybody thinks on either side or all sides or any side is a perfect solution, but people have agreed that this is a good compromise that's in the best interest of all the parties.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator.
So, Senator S., so the adoption agencies in the next year or so will be trying to contact as many birth parents as possible that have not put a affidavit on record saying that they do not want
pre-1977.
And they think they'll have pretty high success at contacting these folks to tell them, because when they
that,
gave up
that
their
has
children,
been the case in the past and in other states, Oregon and Michigan, I think is the Massachusetts, Michigan is the latest ones, that the public service announcement type things, the efforts of the agencies themselves and their materials, the Department of Health here, and quite frankly, there's going to be a great reliance on the religious communities, the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis is going to be participating in that kind of outreach. So we feel very confident that the population of birth mothers that do not currently, and some of them, the pre-77s also have affidavits on file, but that the that any of them that do not, that there probably is going to be, as much as practicable, the information available to those birth parents.
Mr. Chair.
Including ones that don't live in the state.
So it won't just depend on
news, a website,
news and media and website, but they will make an effort to contact those people directly, especially those who live out of state. Those are the ones I'm most concerned about. They left here after giving up their children, knowing that the law said that they could keep their privacy. And now we're changing the law after they're maybe gone. And I just want to make sure, because this can be a pretty startling thing for a family, maybe not the birth mother, but for the rest of the family to find out. And I can imagine that, you know, some people question, the trust levels and relationships can be affected and things like that. I mean, it's a pretty big deal. And so,
yes, indeed it is.
I want to make sure that these birth mothers are not going to be surprised by our change in the law.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, the concerns that you're raising are ones in the past that have been raised by the adoption agencies in particular. And they have, which is why they didn't want just a single date, and after that anybody can have their birth certificate, because they and I certainly respect the right of birth parents to not wish contact and to not have their names be available to their birth children. And again, this has been what we have here is the compromise that the agencies and the advocates in the adoption community have agreed is in the best interests of all. And all of those interests have been weighed here. And this compromise is not taken lightly. And we feel that we have this year, since it's not, you can't do this until July 1 of next year, that we have the opportunity to see the impact of the outreach efforts. And if something is amiss or doesn't go as expected, we have a legislative session before anybody could get a birth certificate, because you couldn't get it until July 1st, even apply for it until July 1st of next year. But this gives us an opportunity to have those outreach efforts to see how successful they are, and then if the provisions need to be modified, we have the opportunity to do that in the next legislative session. So there are lots of safeguards here.
Further questions on the bill?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
I'll move the bill for Senator Rest.
Okay.
And I just want to be clear, the special revenue is paid by the adoption agencies. Is that who's paying the revenue, or is it people requesting the record?
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to defer to fiscal analyst, Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Mossman.
Senator Berglund, the special revenues are fees that are collected from people who are seeking adoption records.
Okay.
Okay. Further questions? Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 3193 be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Rest. Then.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Larson has been waiting patiently. Senate File 1527.
I'll move the division report for Senate File 1527.
Okay, Senator Betzel moves it after the division report. Is there further discussion on the motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill would establish a presidential primary beginning in the presidential election of 2012. Taking you back just a little bit, I introduced this bill a year ago with hopes that we would be able to establish a presidential primary for the 2008 election. And the bill was heard in subcommittee, state and local government full committee, and then in the finance, Senator Betzold's finance division. But given the limited resources available and the cost of that election, we were unable to establish that primary for 2008. I think in hindsight, it would have really been nice for Minnesota voters to have that primary available. As we recall, Caucus Day 2008, we had an incredible turnout that was far beyond expectations. For many in Minnesota, it was one of the most exhilarating days of being a citizen, of seeing the turnout that we've had and the interest in presidential politics. For many others, however, it was an experience in frustration and an experience in disenfranchisement from their political process. And we have seen an increased interest in participation of our presidential process in 2004, a huge increase in 2008, and I believe that increased interest will continue into the future. Having a system that Minnesotans can rely upon to handle the kind of turnout that we are seeing in presidential elections, we have that process, but that process is a primary process that is run very effectively by the Secretary of State of Minnesota and all the local units of government across Minnesota who make Minnesota's election process known as very possibly and what I believe to be the best in the nation. And so this bill will establish that process for 2012 so that every 4 years we have a presidential primary. And the bill also prescribes that that would be the day that, in addition, we would have precinct caucuses in Minnesota. So the caucus would be the same day as the presidential primary, presuming that the parties agreed that that they wanted to hold it that day. In addition to that, the bill provides for the Secretary of State flexibility in determining what date would be that the primary would be held on. The reason for that, as we see the national debate about presidential selection and how that timeline has moved up, we allow for a time frame that could be adjusted so that Minnesota could participate in a regional primary system. If, for example, the Midwest were to go on a particular date in January or February, we would be allowed to participate in that as well. Short of a regional primary system, it would require that the primary be held no earlier than the first week after presumably the Iowa caucuses and no later than 5 weeks following the Iowa caucuses. The regional primary concept would kick in if more than one state were the first in the nation to hold a caucus or primary. Under those circumstances, we could join them in that effort. The bill comes to this committee with, for a couple of reasons, there's rulemaking in the bill, and there is an A6 amendment that addresses that and removes that expense from the 2010 fiscal year. And then the other issue is the cost in the 2012. A year to the state and to local units of government for the cost of the election. And that would be an issue, I know, that will get considerable discussion as we move toward that election. But I would argue that this is a core function of government. And we could not have predicted the outcome or the turnout of interest in our presidential selection during this last election. And so for the folks that were unable to vote, for the folks who could not cast a absentee ballot, for all the folks who couldn't participate, it's understandable that we couldn't anticipate it. But we've now had that tsunami of turnout, and we can now anticipate it. And I contend that if we proceed to another four-year period of time where the presidential selection plays out and we, again, don't handle that turnout, then we have disenfranchised as a state people who want to participate in that process. And so with that, members, I'd stand for questions, but that's the presidential primary bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berlin.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Larson, there are people who make a very valid argument that this is not a core function of government, but this is a core function of our political parties who choose their candidate to run in an election. And that election is a core function of government, but choosing a presidential nominee of a political party, I think a pretty strong argument can be made that that is a function of the political party and should not necessarily be an expenditure that is required of local units of government.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, you know, in Minnesota, though, we really do, from my perspective, consider it a core function of government, that primary process. In our state primary process, our parties do select candidates, but then essentially there's a second selection that occurs during the during a state-held primary that does, in fact, choose the candidate that will be on the general election ballot. Presidential selection is a little bit unique because there's not that second opportunity for the general public to weigh in. Because there's not an endorsement process followed by that primary process, the only chance for someone to participate is in that political process that, again, this last election left many, many, many people unable to participate. And so I certainly understand that the political parties that this is a process that interacts with their ability to select a candidate. But I would submit that this is Minnesotans' only shot at influencing that. And given that that's the case, I think we have to have a process that is as open as possible.
Senator Larson, let me ask a couple of questions. And you and I have had a chance to talk about this, although we haven't talked about it much this year. In the aftermath, despite where we sit respectively on the floor, but haven't talked much about it this year in the aftermath of February 5th. You're suggesting that this is an issue that rises to a higher level given what happened on the 5th. And I was really excited by the turnout. I won't say I predicted the turnout, although I told the Obama campaign in December that I thought there was a chance of turnout on our side of well in excess of 100,000. I was off by about 100,000, but certainly I thought there'd be a turnout on the Democratic side way in excess of what took place 4 years ago. Was it just the right, was it the perfect political storm all the talk about this is the first time since 1952 that there was not a candidate, an incumbent president or vice president running, that you, I'll speak only on our side of it, an unusual combination of candidates. And so would we expect to see something of this sort again? So are we dashed into a presidential primary without maybe understanding that this was totally unique?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that we can know the answer to that until we see the future play out. However, as I know our local district prepared for this year's caucuses, we tried to use as a baseline what was a historic turnout in 2004. And we wondered if it could possibly be as large as 2004 was on the Democratic side. And the general feeling was it may well be as large. And we had no idea that it would be that much larger. And so I think it's difficult to predict that this, in fact, it can only occur when we are selecting two candidates, when there is no incumbent in the race, I think with the change in how people receive their media and how real-time elections are becoming, that we may see a period in our history where we have greater participation. And I'm hoping that what's happened from 2004 to 2008 is the beginning of a trend line of participation all across our country in terms of people feeling empowered to have their voice heard. That's what drives me and supporters of this to have this in place so that people don't feel disenfranchised. I think we have an opportunity to fix some of the problems from what I think is not the process is not in place to handle the kind of turnout we had. We really had a larger turnout than the parties than they reported, because many, many thousands of people did not end up participating because they had to leave, and they couldn't find parking. It was inaccessible, et cetera, et cetera. We had people all across Minnesota showing up at the polls to vote because of the way the candidates had put a television on that said you could vote on Tuesday. And people were calling city clerks saying, how come the polls aren't open, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think that this is a better thing to have in place so that we're prepared. And hopefully we won't be underwhelmed.
I want to be a little bit careful about getting too far astray from the fiscal issues in front of us as opposed to the policy issues. But I will ask a couple of other questions. Does the language of the bill mandate that candidates have to be on the ballot?
$500 worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does not mandate that they have to be on the ballot. It provides for a process by which they would apply to be on the ballot.
Okay. But the Secretary of State does not have the ability to put somebody's name on the ballot without that candidate's permission through filing of the affidavit.
That's correct. Okay.
And then in terms of a couple of other questions, the date, I'm trying to follow. And one of the things that's happened this year, of course, is that's been quite unusual, particularly on the Democratic side, is almost every state has become an important state. But there was this effort to just shove everything to February 5th, and we're not in this committee going to go over what happened with Michigan and Florida. But I hope we don't. But what – I can't quite follow the dates. Do we help exacerbate a situation where every state was making an attempt to grab an early date?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tried to address that in a responsible way in that it was never my goal to try to be the first state. And so, frankly, the way the bill was drafted was to prevent us from being the first state unless we end up in a regional primary system or a national primary system that has more than one Midwest state going first. If Iowa and Wisconsin and South Dakota are going to have their primary or caucuses on that first date, then the Secretary of State has the flexibility with this language to join them, to have Minnesota join them. Short of that, if Iowa is the first state of caucuses, the first state in the Midwest to hold their caucus, we cannot hold our caucus until after that date.
But Mr. Chair.
Sarah Higgins.
Senator Larson, on 2.31, it says the date must be no earlier than the date of the first primary or the caucus. But conceivably, we could be on the same day as Iowa with this language.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, as long as it's Iowa and another Midwest state.
That's not what it says.
I would add, I know that the language is a little difficult and confusing, and I've struggled with it a little bit, but I think Mr. Watson could explain to us why that's the case.
Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, 232 says held in more than one state in the Midwest.
No earlier than the date of the first primary or caucus held in more than one state.
Only one state.
Well, I think Senator Higgins' point is a good one, Senator Larson.
This still
would allow us to be on the same day of date as Iowa. So if two states decide, Minnesota and Wisconsin,
but it could be
to be held on the same day as Iowa, we'll have the same problems that Michigan and Florida are having right now. So I'm not sure I care that it would be on the same time as some other second state, because I won't. I'd have to defer to Senator Fischbach and Senator Roebling for help with the RNC, but the DNC will say your delegates don't count.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, the RNC is getting along really well right now, so we're doing.
It's because you only have one candidate.
Well, the chair inquired, and I wanted to make sure his question was answered.
And I appreciate that, Senator Fischbach, but I. Because I'm a little bit more conversant with what's going on our side of the aisle in that regard. But I do think, Senator Larson, again, I want to be a little bit careful because this is the Finance Committee, so I want to be a little bit careful about starting to rewrite your bill. But, again, I think Senator Higgins makes a good point, and the Minnesota delegates would be in some jeopardy if that language remains.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Watson.
Might I suggest on line 2.32 after 1 insert other? It's more than one other state?
No.
Still doesn't do it.
That if our primary is the same date as the Iowa caucuses, we will place our delegates in jeopardy, whether it's 1, 2, 3, or 10 other states. Unless there's a regional primary. Determined either by the federal, by the Congress, or arguably by the two political parties acting in concert with each other.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if there's another way to fix that, but that was the intent of this legislation, was to not put ourselves in that harm's way with the DNC or the RNC, but to provide this flexibility if we have a national primary develop that is endorsed by the political parties. The goal here was to provide the flexibility to the Secretary of State to avoid Minnesota being in a situation, and not prescribe the date, but to avoid us being in the same situation as Michigan and Florida.
I don't want to rework this bill in the Finance Committee, and to be honest, the Conference Committee is going to meet very shortly, so we're not going to have time to rework the entire bill. Senator Larson, I hope that whenever you bring this bill up on the floor by way of the bill itself or by amendment, that you can revisit that section. And I don't know if Ms. Frazier has anything to offer us, but I don't know if there's been any consultation with the DNC or the RNC relative to that language, but Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair, Beth Frazier with the Secretary of State's office. On 2.28, it says that the date must be set by the Secretary of State in consultation with the major parties. And we would certainly, work with them to pick a date that works for both the RNC and the DNC. So we would not pick a date that then would invalidate your delegates or keep them from being seen.
Senator Higgins?
And Mr. Chair, I think what should happen is that this subdivision should be divided out so that it makes reference to the goal of getting to a regional primary separate from setting the date that cannot be the Iowa date. Yeah. And it's just an amendment that will happen.
Senator Larson, if you can spend a few minutes with that. Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair. I've got a young man here that come all the way from someplace or another and would like to say a few words on this, if it's possible.
Please.
Okay, we're not going to have a chance for a lot of testimony, but sure, if you'd like to testify for a minute. If you can identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Mr. Brandon K. Roche, and me and the senator actually haven't had an opportunity to sort of discuss what he's put forth before you all, but I have been one of those people who attended the precinct caucus and one of those who had felt a bit disenfranchised when I left the caucus in the way the process kind of turned out. However, based on kind of my review of the Federalist Papers and of the Constitution and sort of the process of the way it works, it's kind of just like this. It's a little bit messy. Sometimes you don't get your voice across or you don't get what you want across because there's so much on the table. And as you look at your tables right now, there's some people that aren't even here because they have other things going on. and that's kind of how it works in that process. And with the precinct caucus, I felt it was sort of useful for me because you just don't show up and vote and leave. You have to kind of get actively involved in the process that's taking place. And too many people my age kind of like to complain a lot about politics and like to complain a lot about the process, but don't necessarily get involved in the actual hands-on activities like being here today or like just simply going to attend a caucus and putting forth your ideas on the platform. And so I personally prefer the precinct caucus because it allows you to get forth your ideas at least to a local level on the platform. And at the same time, it also allows you to get your hands messy and know how government really works. It's not perfect. It doesn't work smoothly, which I'm sure you all can see as you sit here and kind of look a little frustrated because maybe this bill hasn't worked or that bill hasn't worked or this one hasn't gone across. And to me, the presidential primary just simply is vote and leave. And who are we to complain as a people if that's all we're doing is voting and leaving when we really need to get actively engaged in our government and actively involved in what's going on? Otherwise, it's gonna deteriorate itself as we slowly see it doing. And I'm sorry me and the senator haven't had an opportunity to sort of discuss this bill, and I genuinely know that this is from the heart. However, I personally feel different about that, and I'm sure other people do as well. However, I appreciate the senator's bill and the intentions of it. And I wish I was more well prepared for the presentation, but I thank you, Senator Foley, for the opportunity to speak.
No, that's fine. Appreciate your comments. Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate that. Senator Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just one other comment, and that is I obviously, Senator Larson and I don't necessarily see eye to eye on whether this is a party responsibility or not, but I would say this. If we're going to have a presidential primary in Minnesota, it's going to bring in millions, if not billions, of dollars of advertising, which seems to be part of the assumption that somehow that can be afforded. On the other hand, this bill is causing local units of government to have unfunded costs, which, you know, will fall on the property taxpayer in that local community. It'll either mean an increase in property taxes or squeezing out of other services. And I just have trouble with that. I just have to say I have trouble with that. You know, somehow if we can create a system that can afford all this advertising to influence the general population on how they should be voting to nominate candidates for parties to put up for election, then somehow we ought to be able to figure out how that system can pay for a presidential primary without making it be an unfunded local mandated cost.
Senator Bitzel.
On that point, Mr. Chair, Senator, the State and Local Government Committee actually spent quite a few hours talking about some of these very issues, and we did have some testimony actually from the elections clerk of my city in Fridley, who testified as to what Senator Berglund said, that it isn't her responsibility overseeing elections to incur the cost to help the political parties decide who their candidates are going to be. However, she also noted that this particular year, that's exactly what they spent, you know, all day doing on February 5 and around that time period because of the voter confusion, thinking that this was a primary election that day. So they incurred a lot of costs that they wish that they could have had reimbursed or paid for because this wasn't their responsibility, but they got caught up in it anyway. So we do have, you know, that conundrum here.
Okay. And I appreciate those comments because they relate to the cost. And so I'm going to backtrack and ask one more policy question. And that is, I'm trying to follow the language as to the determination of the delegates themselves. Can you just run over that again?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The delegates will be selected individually as the delegates are currently selected under party rules and under or as the party determines those individuals to be selected. However, this bill would have the parties determine the apportionment by the outcome of the primary. And if parties, currently we have two forms of public subsidy for parties, the checkoff and the PCR program that parties participate in. And this is an incentive, if you will, that says that if political parties bind their apportionment of delegates, again, the caucus process and convention process would determine who those delegates are, but presuming that they're apportioned or certified to be apportioned as was the primary, then they will continue to receive for that calendar year those public subsidies. If, in fact, though, the party does not choose to acknowledge the presidential primary, then those the opportunity for those dollars would be forfeited for that calendar year.
And just a comment, maybe we can get relative to that. What happened previously, of course, is, and certainly the legislature can't bind the operations of a political party. And what happened previously is that the parties decided that the selection of delegates would be independent of the presidential primary, so nobody really cared about the presidential primary. If we find ourselves in the situation where the political parties in this state decide that they will have delegates selected through the caucus process and not the primary process, then no candidate will care about Minnesota. It'll be ignored, and that'll be inevitable. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Larson, and I don't remember this provision before, and I've heard the bill a couple of times, but I'm trying to figure out, so are we saying that Republican candidates would be ineligible? Because who of a presidential candidate gets state checkoff dollars? We check off on our federal form. That goes into a presidential fund. We check off on our state form, and I thought that all went into a fund that was for state candidates who agreed to abide by the spending limits. So what dollars are you talking about having control over?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling. A portion of those dollars are appropriated to the central committees of the major political parties. And so, no, this would not, for example, if the Republican Party didn't abide by the proportions, would not mean that candidates across the state would lose their checkoff or lose their ability to be in the PCR program. It would be for the party unit itself, the state party unit, that is choosing not to bind its process by the outcome of the primary, again, for the remainder of that calendar year. Even the use of those funds up to that time, we don't restrict. But it's from that point forward, the party would not, for its party unit fundraising, have the ability to use the PCR. And the general or the party account money that would come directly to the RNC or the DN, the state Republican Party or the state Democratic Party, that expenditure would not arrive. They would essentially forfeit that by not being bound. It's not a huge amount of money, and I don't have the number from the last election, but there's some amount of money that goes to our central committees from that checkup dollar.
Mr. Chair, but now when we're talking about binding delegates, you know, like immediately what happened after the caucuses this year, a lot of candidates left. I mean, they dropped off. So what do you? So we're telling the parties that they would have to bind delegates according to that vote in the primary for candidates who are no longer viable by the time the convention comes along. How are we going to tell them they have to do this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling. It would be the proportion of the vote that they received is what would be required for those candidates. So let's say Senator McCain and Senator Romney in this for this analogy, whatever percentage of the vote that they received would be the percentage of delegates that they would be required to be apportioned. Now, the rest of those would be chosen through the political process, and if there are other candidates who are no longer in the race, the political party would have its process for apportioning those. It creates a floor so that if Senator McCain received 40% of that vote, he wouldn't be able to get less than 40, and he was still in the race, he wouldn't be able to get less than 40% of the delegates coming out of, you know, Minnesota that were committed to him.
But, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
But the delegates that are originally chosen in a process for candidates who drop out of the race, then they're just unpledged. They're just released from their pledge, right? Like that would happen in the political party process.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, and then the political parties would have their rules to determine what proportion, you know, how those delegates would be proportioned. We're not trying to further prescribe how those delegates should be apportioned. It creates essentially a floor for candidates. And it says that if Senator Obama got 60% of the vote in Minnesota, that 60% of the delegates would be pledged to him. The party would be required to continue to receive those state funds to have its 60% of its delegates at its state convention be Obama delegates. He may leave with 70% because other candidates may have dropped out, but he would be assured of the 60%.
All right. Is there Senator Roblin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have expressed this in other committees, but I have some concerns about this, and also I think Senator Cohen raised the same concern that what happened this year may be quite unusual, that it may not happen in 4 years, it may not happen in 8 years, it may not happen in 12 or 16 years, that we would have the turnout that we had. It would be nice if that were not the case, if we had this turnout all the time, because it's a good problem to have. But we are expecting local units of government to pick up a pretty significant portion of this cost, because the appropriation in here is very small. And I guess that I just think that the process, the political party should be allowed to choose their own method. And this is something that putting the cost on local units of government for a party process is simply not appropriate.
Well, Mr. Chair, and then Senator Roebling, and a little bit to the conversation that Senator Berglund and I had about this, then we really ought to get rid of the state primary, because the state primary provides exactly that function. The state primary selects the party's candidate for the fall election, and that is the basis of our election infrastructure in Minnesota, and our tradition and history, is that while candidates are nominated, the public provides a selection system in the fall primary, in the September primary. That would not be necessary if we allow parties to choose that candidate.
Mr. Chair. But the primary also narrows the candidates for county commissioner, for sheriff, for county attorney, for even school boards now. And so, you know, those are nonpartisan posts. It simply narrows the number of candidates. And so it isn't quite comparable, because a lot of those, especially in greater Minnesota, those are not partisan races at all.
But, Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, we do select governor. We select our United States senators. We pretty consistently have selected those partisan offices in political primaries. And so I'd make the argument that, in fact, we have a tradition in Minnesota of helping to be part of that selection process. In the presidential selection process, so Minnesotans have two opportunities if they want to influence who's governor. They can go to their caucus, and they can go through that process. But ultimately, they get an opportunity in September to go and voice their position on their party's choice, whether or not they like that choice or they have a different choice. For president, that's not available. The nomination is chosen at a different place on its own, and Minnesotans are only allowed the opportunity one time, and that's in a process that did not allow itself access to many, many people. At our precinct caucus night, my intention was to show up and visit each of my precincts and move to the next building that I had, and then the third building that I had. And the first half of the night, I spent trying to get people to rooms, in many cases helping disabled people get to a second floor in a school that was very, very difficult for them. We had an election playing out in a two-hour period of time. and we had election turnout. And if you just compare what we had in this last caucus to what is possible in a primary, if you go back to 1992, there were actually more people that turned out for the 1992 presidential primary that was not binding than turned out on caucus night for both of our parties. So we allow more of the public to participate.
Mr. Chairman, I think
that's a good thing.
Mr. Chairman.
Part of this is my fault. I've been a major offender. But I told Mr. Mott, you bring a presidential primary bill into my committee, and I'm going to participate in a somewhat broader way. But the conference committee is going to start in a few minutes, and so we have a bill of Senator Latz, and we're going to have to make some decisions fairly quickly.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion.
Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that Senate Bill 1527 as amended be recommended to pass. Okay.
We haven't amended it yet.
Well, we have an amendment that has to be offered first.
All right, I'll withdraw my motion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to respond to what Senator Larson said. The suggestion that you're making in your comments is the only way to remedy the problem that occurred in the last precinct caucus system is to have a presidential primary. I would like to suggest that the political parties, through their rules, could allow for absentee balloting to go on for presidential preference and have those ballots mailed in and distributed appropriately to the precincts that had the caucuses if people wanted to just vote for a presidential preference and not have to show up in person to do so.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I would submit, and this is a whole, this would be a whole different debate that we've had some of in the elections subcommittee and in state and local government, and that is by the way the process played out that night is not one that I think any of us would be proud of from a election security system. I mean, where essentially we were holding an election with ballots, in many cases, ripped up pieces of paper and Post-it notes that were put in oftentimes Kleenex boxes that were then everybody gathered down in Bloomington's case at the sports page, which is the local 3-2 joint, to gather the ballots. And, I mean, so there's a whole other bucket of issues here as it relates to parties holding an election in a short period of time that I think is a concern when you have the kinds of turnout that we have. I think if you look at all the things that happened in the stories that I heard about from this last precinct caucus, you know, the number of voting rights violations would be, you know, be unbelievable. Not intentional, just because we had such an incredible turnout, and we had all these wonderful volunteers who really rose to the occasion and did as much as they could possibly.
That's an interesting comment, Senator Larson, about Bloomington. I went to college in the Chicago area, and I recall voting places being in after-hours joints. So I've never heard that in Minnesota. Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think this legislation is ripe for this type, and I would move to lay it on the table.
Okay. We have Senator Foley's motion to lay the bill on the table.
It's not debatable.
Normally that's non-debatable.
Normally mean we can debate it?
Well, you know, obviously we have looser rules in a committee, but normally such a motion is non-debatable. So let me call for the vote. All those in favor of Senator Foley's motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion fails.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I'll move the A6 amendment.
I think we should call for division.
Well,
too late.
We're kind of wondering about that, Mr. Chair.
Well, people know the rules. All right, there's an amendment that needs to be distributed. Is that correct?
We have it.
Oh, you have it? Okay. Does anybody, Senator Higgins, you moved adoption of the amendment. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right, this is the A6 amendment. Is there further discussion of the amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries.
And then, Mr. Chair, I'll move that Senate File 1527 as amended be recommended to pass.
Okay, we have Senator Higgins' motion that Senate File 1527 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed.
No.
Motion carries.
Division.
Division. All those in favor of the Higgins motion, that the bill has been recommended to pass, raise your hand. And all those opposed to the motion.
It's up to the chair.
Okay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
The chair votes aye.
All right. Senator Latz has promised that Senate File 3189 will take 30 to 40 seconds.
Starting now.
I'll move
one.
The division report, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Betzel moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, members, this is a technical correction bill. When the statutes were amended in 1993 to add a controlled substance offense for juveniles, it was neglected to add that statutory reference to the reinstatement fee requirement elsewhere in the law. It was realized that there was an oversight, so up until now, juveniles who have been convicted of a controlled substance offense in a motor vehicle have been able to get reinstated with the driving privileges only with the application fee, but not with the separate reinstatement fee that everyone else who gets revoked has to pay. So this bill would add that statute to the $30 reinstatement fee provision. It was an oversight at the time. This corrects that oversight. It would have the salutary effect of bringing in about $51,000, I think, to the general fund once it's implemented.
Mr. Mosman,
for questions. Mr. Chair, members, just one clarification. The revenues would be to the miscellaneous special revenue fund, not to the general fund.
Okay. I'll move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 3189 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Latz.